Hello, I'm Elon Musk, and I'm here to buy some lithium.
Ah, yes, Musk, come on in. Pull up a chair. Rest your ilium.
Yes, I'll sit, but don't try to sweet-talk me, because I will only pay the bare minimum. It can't be very expensive. It's down there between helium and beryllium. Now, if you need to hire more workers, Tesla will build you a condominium. But without a good supply, our plans fall into disequilibrium. You should take workers off the line making lithium grease. We'll need every man to produce an exponential increase.
What's wrong there? Why are you raising your supercilium?
Well, because, Musk, frankly, it's very clear to me that you're about as smart as a paramecium.
Which ones?
Hear ye, hear ye, all ye who hear this here podcast, know this. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing discussed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. The hosts hold no licenses and are not financial advisors. Do your own research before making investment decisions, and we do hope you enjoy this podcast.
All systems are ready, and so we are ready.
Joe Lowry, welcome to TC's Charcast. So great that you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's great. This is one of the benefits of Battery Day. We got to know you as you and I DM'd back and forth during Tesla's Battery Day last week. And we thought it would be wonderful for the audience to get a deep dive background on lithium mining from one of the leading minds and one of the leading thought leaders in the space. And so that's what we're here to do today. But before we dive in, as is our show, tell the audience who Joe Lowry is, where you were born, where you went to school, and then how you ended up being one of the foremost experts in lithium mining that you are today.
I was born in a very small Irish Catholic town about an hour south of Buffalo, New York, near the Pennsylvania border. I grew up with playing a lot of sports and doing a lot of reading, and I developed from reading a desire to travel the world. And when I went to college in Oklahoma and came home, ran a fire extinguisher plant for a couple of years, made the flight line fire extinguishers for the F-16. Back then they were Halon 1211, which I don't even think is used anymore. But I then decided to go to graduate school, went to the University of Georgia, got an MBA, went to work for a large oil company for 5 years. And this was in the late 80s when breaking up companies was kind of the theme of the day. And the oil company I worked for got broken up. And as part of the recruiting process, companies came in looking at those people in the oil company, and FMC recruited me. I went to work for their gold mining division in Reno, Nevada. And they had the second lowest cost mine ever found in North America, Paradise Peak, which was actually a silver mine with associated gold, but we're getting into the weeds there. I then looked to move on within the FMC structure and thought that lithium would be interesting just because it was a very small niche business. And I had done some research and found that it was involved with so many different types of industries. It just seemed interesting to me. So I put my hat in the ring. The lithium division hired me, and I was in finance back then. So I was running their finance department. And after a year and a half, I told the guy running the business that I didn't want to go brain dead. I wanted to get into the commercial area. And I did that. And in 1992, started working in the commercial side of the lithium business. And serendipitously, I started to travel internationally. And about the time that the lithium ion battery was really becoming commercial, our company's lithium was the lithium selected. There were only two Western players at the time. So I inherited the lithium ion battery business and I had 100% of the supply for the first few years. And then it got too big for one company. And I moved to Asia in 2000, lived in Japan for 5.5 years, lived in China for 5.5 years, So that was great serendipitous training for what I do now, because I know all the major players, both in the cathode and in the battery space. And I, work with the Chinese lithium producers also. So I came back to the United States beginning of 11, was unceremoniously fired on September 10th, 2012. And I have a nice blog post I can refer to people to read about that. I was actually called in and told that there was a new org chart. Do you notice anything? And I said, what, that I'm not on it? And I said, yeah, I got that. So I drove home, talked to my wife, and I started Global Lithium virtually the next day. And over the last eight years, I've been advising lithium companies, lithium purchasers, governments, hedge funds, you name it. And it's a much more lucrative job than I had working for my former employer. So it all worked out.
Well, Joe, you certainly have been sitting in the catbird seat to watch this incredible evolution of the lithium industry from the time you got into it into what we're experiencing today. And I have no doubt that your professional life is probably much more fulfilling, being your own boss, as you describe it, and kind of naming your destiny. TC and I have certainly found the same, in doing this podcast and some of the other things that we do. Our goal today with this discussion, because most of our audience will be very unfamiliar with the inner workings of lithium mining and the dynamics of the lithium industry. Maybe they might be familiar from a high-level point of view, and certainly our audience is very involved in the EV space and understanding that. So our goal today is really to give people a good handle on what are the drivers of the lithium industry, supply, demand, who are the key players, and then we can talk about some of the specific claims that were made during Battery Day. But let's start at kind of providing a primer for our listeners on the industry. And to kind of walk us into that, one of the things I'd love to read from your website, you have some great material there. And recently you wrote something about the industry that maybe might be a way for us to get into it, which is, you say, quote, "The most damning assumption made by supposed experts is that the lithium chemicals going into high-end EV batteries are a commodity and will behave from a supply and demand point of view as other commodities do," end quote. So why don't you describe the industry and explain that statement, why the supply and demand dynamics of a typical commodity do not apply here?
Okay, this is where you might have to rein me in, because I tend to wax long on the subject. But when I started in the industry, there was no lithium ion battery business. And the two main players, which have had many name changes, or at least one of them has. So if you look at the lithium industry today, and I'll go back and forth, today the top four lithium companies are Albemarle, which is based in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I am, but they're production is in Chile and Western Australia and China. And SQM, which is a Chilean company, and they're also on the Atacama Salar in Chile, nearby Albemarle. And then you have two Chinese players who, when I started in the industry, we didn't even have China in our budget presentations. That's how fast the rise of China has been. But there's two companies. One's called Ganfeng, very good friends of mine. And the other one is Tianqi. And Tianqi, I know the guy who started Tianqi quite well. One of the benefits of having lived and worked in China. And then my former employer, who used to be one of the quote-unquote big three lithium companies when we only looked at the kind of the Western world, was called FMC Lithium for decades and is now called Livent. It was spun off. So those are kind of, I mean, you have, I'll extend the majors to Livent. So we have five lithium companies. And lithium is produced right now in two key ways. One is from brine production from salars, primarily in Chile and Argentina. There is some brine production in China, but it tends to be of significantly lower quality than South America. And then you have hard rock. Hard rock is basically ore that's mined in primarily Western Australia, although there is, as Elon Musk likes to say, lithium everywhere. Western Australia is the dominant miner of hard rock lithium, but they don't produce lithium chemicals yet commercially in Australia. The spodumene concentrate that they produce from the mined ore is shipped to China and is converted by both integrated assets. Tianqi owns a mine or owns part of a mine in Western Australia. Ganfeng owns part of a mine in Western Australia and has minority interest in another asset. And so that those are basically the two processes, one's brine and one's from hard rock. And there's been a litany of misinformation about which one's better and what the future holds for lithium production in the past few years, because it tends to be that if I went on a trip, business trip 15 years ago and said I was in the lithium business, unless somebody had a manic depressive relative, the eyes glazed over. In the last 10 years, obviously, the preponderance of lithium ion batteries, people at least have, they know lithium's something. They don't really tend to know what it is. So in the last, Tesla, the rise of Tesla has created this whole new level of interest in lithium, I would say. And the rise of EVs in China, the same thing. So to get to why lithium chemicals aren't a commodity is fairly simple, because most of the processing for lithium and a lot of the larger assets that are producing the lithium that's going into EVs now were either built or designed before lithium ion batteries existed. And the basic use of lithium, the original use of lithium, was to get the trigger for the hydrogen bomb. And that was not a sophisticated quality of lithium hydroxide that was needed to go through the Y-12 process in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And if somebody wants to research that, Google's a great source of, you can go down that rabbit hole. The government stockpiled, the U.S. government, the Russians had a lithium program and so did the Chinese. Lithium was stockpiled. And about 50 years ago, the government basically said, hey, actually, it was over 50 years ago, we don't need any more lithium for this use. So the lithium players had to come up with commercial applications. And the first three big lithium applications were glass production, were grease, a multipurpose grease, and aluminum smelting. And when I entered the industry, that those were the big three lithium demands. And now lithium is not used very often in aluminum smelting because the smelters have developed technology that really obviates the need for lithium in most cases. Glass is still a significant demand. And, grease grows at GDP. So the whole future of lithium is really dependent on what happens with battery. And when I started selling to the battery industry in the 90s, they basically had selected FMC, one type of material FMC made. FMC had a continuous process and a batch process. They selected the material from the batch process. These were early days. The battery guys didn't really know how to use lithium efficiently. They didn't really know what type of lithium would be optimal. It was very much a learning experience for both the battery guys and particularly the cathode makers, because that's where the lithium resides in the battery and the cathode. And so I kind of lived through that. We tried to find out just what the secret sauce is, what were they really looking for? And in many cases, depending on who you were dealing with, they wanted to tell you part of the story because they didn't want what they were discovering about their particular technology being communicated to their competitors. So this was definitely a specialty type situation, not a commodity. Lithium was not interchangeable. for the first few years of the industry, my competitor's material, and I say competitors plural because China was just starting to try to export lithium chemicals in the late 90s. And SQM had just entered the industry in 1997. So we went from two players to three, which was what I referred to the big three lithium players. That was the late 90s when SQM entered. And most of the industry didn't want Chinese material because it was very low quality. And so you really look, the world view of the lithium industry is the big three. And the big three's products were not interchangeable. It took my competitors several years to get qualified. But even when they were qualified by battery makers, and back then, most of the use was for cell phones, and there was still almost a year qualification process if you wanted to sell a lithium chemical to a cathode maker. They ran basic chemistry tests, then they ran half coin cell tests, then they ran full charge-discharge tests, and then material would be qualified. But the best example I can give you of why it's not a commodity, and I will try to keep this short, is when I first started selling to Sumitomo Metal Mining, who makes the cathode for Tesla. They make the NCA. The Nissan Leaf was about to be commercialized also. And the Nissan Leaf used a blended cathode of NCA, the same thing Tesla uses, and LMO, lithium manganese. But when I would go to each, this was both Japanese companies, and when I would go to each company that was making the essentially the same thing, NCA, nickel, cobalt, aluminum cathode, what they were concerned about was completely different. One of the players focused intensely on metallic contamination. The other player focused on morphology of the crystal and having a uniform assay in the bag. And it was like I was talking to people from two different universes. And they were literally making the same thing. And that's probably the best cathode example I can give you of why it's not a commodity. Look at the LME attempting to come up with a lithium product. It's not a fungible good. If you just look at the definition of commodity in the dictionary and line it up against the characteristics of lithium chemicals, it doesn't qualify.
So, Joe, it's fascinating to think about because the predominant use of the commodity outlet from the lithium mines resides in the battery space, but there is a specialty conversion step between what is sort of mined and produced, either lithium hydroxide or lithium carbonate, versus what the battery makers can actually accept. Is that basically the broad strokes of the point you just made?
Well, the broad strokes would be that a glass manufacturer, particularly what's called FRIT, which is a borosilicate glass, they don't care particularly if the lithium is 97% lithium, or lithium carbonate, or 99.8, because they're a smelter. A lot of the nasties are easy to deal with, or in some cases, they actually want what the battery guys would consider the nasties in the batch. In the battery, it's just much more rigorous. And here's another point for people that are looking at investment. When a junior miner says, we're going to make 99.9% lithium carbonate battery grade, that's not what defines the 99. The assay doesn't define whether a battery maker can use the lithium. It's the 0.5 that defines it. And what's in the 0.5 and the stability of what's in the 0.5, that is a much greater concern than the assay. You could have a 99.8% lithium carbonate that was unusable for a battery maker if the rest of it was sodium or the rest of it was potassium or the rest of it was whatever. I mean, I don't want to get too far into the weeds. So the point I'm making to you is that the industry survived supplying the battery guys for years because they could lot select. Back when I first started, battery demand was a fairly small part of global demand. When it hit 50%, you kind of lost your degrees of freedom. Because I know when I worked for FMC, we lot selected. A lot of our material could be used by the battery guys, and a lot of it couldn't. The Atacama's probably even, has a lower percentage that was able to be used by the battery people. Now all the growth is battery. So when battery becomes 95% of demand, if only 50 or 60% of your natural output qualified to be battery quality, then you got a problem. And that's why the lithium industry has to get better in their process. And that kind of falls into the Elon logic, first principles and all that. Well, that's what was, and I know we're going to talk about Battery Day later, but that was what kind of the joke is that the idea that you can just start a new process of lithium mining that's using table salt and come up with a majority of high quality material when the whole industry has been struggling with the issue for a decade now of how do we get the last mile of impurities out and keep them stable and get the battery guys what they need to have a long lasting EV or even, there's a lot of other applications than EVs that are very quality sensitive.
So delving a little bit more into, as you say, give the battery guys what they need. There's some terminology that we've used that I'd like to kind of understand a little bit better, and maybe our listeners will too. So we've mentioned lithium carbonate and lithium hydroxide. Both of these types, trade at different prices. Some of them are, some producers are producing both, some are producing one or the other. As I understand it, the lithium ion batteries are favoring lithium hydroxide, particularly in the low cobalt versions of the batteries that are being developed. From an education point of view, help us understand the difference between lithium carbonate, lithium hydroxide, for the EV battery application? Is it only one or the other that can be used? And are those, is one from brine, one from the hard rock? Help us understand how it goes from those sources into these two different types and what the implications are for the market demand.
Okay, let's, for the Tesla crowd, Tesla uses high nickel cathode. And so they have no choice but to use lithium hydroxide. And if we look at the range of NCA is a very high nickel cathode and a very low cobalt user. I mean, Sumitomo Metal Mining's cobalt use is about 2.2% by weight, which is much lower than if you were making 811 NMC. And so let me take a step back. The Tesla cathode, that's NCA. Again, they have no choice but to use lithium hydroxide because of the high percentage of nickel. And I have a whole separate podcast I can direct people to that I talk to a battery scientist about why that is. And it's probably, it isn't just about the melting point, but it's connected to that. And you have side reactions. You can't use lithium carbonate if you're nickel content is over 60%, you cannot use lithium carbonate. So that has spurred on this idea that because Tesla has so many fans that, okay, that's the future. And in fairness, the larger European, the high-end cars that want a higher range, and that we'll get into, the high nickel cathodes have higher range, and, the world is, has a lot of people with range anxiety. So That's the driver of the hydroxide market, is the use of high nickel cathodes. However, if you had a choice between those two lithium chemicals, you would always choose lithium carbonate. Lithium carbonate is not an industrial hygiene issue. Lithium carbonate stores for years. If you're using lithium hydroxide and your workers open a bag, if you haven't mechanized that whole process, they're going to be very unhappy, because if you open a bag of lithium hydroxide and take a deep breath, you won't take a second breath near that bag. I promise you. And so there's a whole school of thought that the world is going to lithium hydroxide. And I say the world's going to a balance, because as EVs grow from 2% to 10% and beyond, there's a lot of people that don't need a car that goes 400 miles on a charge or 300 miles. And the lithium batteries, particularly that are being made in China, are mostly with lithium iron phosphate. And even Tesla's now using lithium iron phosphate in some of their Model 3s in China. And the million-mile battery already exists, has existed for a long time if you use lithium iron phosphate, because that cycles forever. And forever being, if forever's 8,000 charges, it lasts forever. And so I see the world in 2025 as still being relatively balanced between hydroxide and carbonate. But if you're part of the Tesla crowd, most of your high-end vehicles are still going to be lithium hydroxide, because as long as you're using cathode with a nickel content over 60%, you have to use hydroxide.
So, Joe, let's summarize a bit, and then I have another question about the sort of size of the market and whether there's enough high-quality lithium to feed the growth projections of both Tesla and the EV market penetration in general. So, one of the things I should say for the audience's benefit is lithium metal itself is one of the most reactive species on the planet, and it's never shipped. And the reason why you ship things around as either lithium hydroxide or lithium carbonate is basically because lithium metal is violently reactive. If you dropped a cube of lithium in water, it would basically explode.
Well, just let me make one point on that. Sorry for the interruption. Lithium metal is shipped all over the world, has been forever. But it's in
oil,
welded steel drums and oil.
Yeah.
just so, cause somebody will Google that.
Sure, and not say, at this scale though, right? I mean, it's a specialty product.
No.
It's super reactive. It's
the first lithium ion battery design was lithium metal anode.
And we'll talk about solid state with lithium metal later. But at scale, by and large, lithium metal is very difficult to handle, and it's soaked in oil for that reason.
Absolutely.
And so one of the sort of things that is interesting as we dove into this is that the market itself is always quoted in LCE, which is lithium carbonate equivalent, which is just basically a percent lithium by weight in the raw materials. So if you have lithium hydroxide, it's a certain LCE. Obviously, lithium carbonate is one LCE. How big is the lithium market today as measured in LCEs? And then for each, say, million EVs, how much sort of LCEs is required, and is there a line of sight to that? Sort of walk us through the size of the market, and then sort of, you know, today the prices for the various lithium materials, even spodumene is very low right now. Lithium carbonate is very low right now. The market is oversupplied. There's an interesting dynamic going on in the market, but before we dive deep into that, sort of walk us through the size of it and what's needed to supply the future demand.
Yeah, this is an interesting topic, because people, when they talk about batteries and when they talk about lithium, they tend to say China dominates. And I don't view it that way, because if you look at tier one battery suppliers, and there's six of them, you know, only one of them is really Chinese, and that's CATL. And CATL's technology origins come from Japan anyway. So if you look at right now pricing, the Japanese and the Koreans are still paying $10,000 a ton and up for lithium carbonate, and a couple thousand, you know, it varies every month depending on the mix and who's buying what, but hydroxide sells for a little more. And that's the cradle of the tier ones is Japan and Korea. Panasonic, LG, Samsung, SDI, you know the names. And in China, the low end of the market is below 4,000 a ton. And it's the same lithium. I mean, on paper, on export statistics, it's the same stuff. Well, then why would it have a price that's so much different? And if we go back just 5 years, in 2015, in September, China was paying more than Korea and Japan, just slightly more. But then there was a, we can say whether it was an artificial shortage or a shortage created that morphed into a real shortage. But within 5 to 6 months, the Chinese spot market price went from 6,000 to the mid-20s. And I was selling, I sold about a little less than 1% of the lithium sold in the world in 2016. And my price was $28,650 for lithium hydroxide because I knew where the sweet spots were. So my point to you is that when there's a shortage that happens, and one will happen soon, pricing will be very volatile. And it didn't kill the battery market back then, and it won't kill the battery market in the future, because lithium, as Elon likes to say, is the salt on the salad. It's not the cost driver in the, you know, the long-term goal to get under $100 a kilowatt hour. The size of the market today, in 2019, and it's, you know, it's really hard to say in the COVID 2020, but it was about three. My number last year was 306,000, which is pretty consistent with other.
That's tons of LCE.
It's 306,000 metric tons of lithium carbonate equivalent. Okay, so if you agree, or I mean, if you look at anybody's forecasts, and actually mine are not on the high end. My 2025 number is still between 850,000 and 900,000 tons of LCE. Some people say a million, some people say 900. In any case, it's substantial growth. And here's the big difference between, you know, people will say, well, this is a commodity because look at what happened to price. And I would say the fact that in the short term of oversupply, the fact that the price to the tier ones who really demand the quality didn't drop anywhere near than the low end did, it shows you that there's a quality difference. But the real factor is that when we had this last spike in price, you know, about 5 years ago, EVs were like less than 1% penetration, and there was still a shortage. And now you're talking about, if you go to 5 or 6 or 10, pick your number of what you believe EV penetration will be in 2025. But if you take Tesla's number for 2030, and he was saying, you know, he basically was saying it was going to be a lithium demand equivalent just for Tesla in 2030 of 2,400,000 tons of LCE. 8 times what it was in 2019. And the way you do that is just take whatever gigawatt or terawatt hours and multiply it by 0.8. And you can debate the exact lithium intensity. It depends on the efficiency of the producer, but 0.8 is a good average. So, and then if you look at the lithium industry's ability to respond, the Atacama producers have announced major expansions, and they've struggled and not met their numbers in any of the last 4 or 5 years. Lithium projects in Argentina, there's only a couple that have the ability to come on in the next 3 or 4 years. And we're talking about it, you know, the scale of a new lithium project tends to be in the 25,000 ton range. So if you're not bringing capital to the industry to develop new projects, and when you do, it's a number like 25,000, we're about to start having growth. The projected demand number for 2020 pre-COVID was around 355 to 360. And then the hockey stick in demand, depending on who you talk to, was supposed to either happen in 21 or 22, because lithium leads the models. You have to have the lithium in place to get the cathode made, for the cells to go into the packs, you know, before the car model year. So if you believe that the new models are going to come out in 23, then the lithium demand is really a 22 issue, and it's not rocket science.
Sounds like there's sort of two constraints. Is there enough mining capacity to meet demand? But then on top of that, you need this specialty conversion processing facilities that can take it to battery grade for each of the tier one battery makers' unique needs. Do you see a shortage in mining capacity, a shortage in processing capacity, or both? And then you have pretty good experience in line of sight to how these things develop over cycles. Are we seeing enough investment in either today to support the projections for EV demand growth that we're seeing, not just for Tesla, but for the entire industry?
Nowhere close. I mean, that's why, I don't know, there's a Twitter handle, the limiting factor, and I wish I'd have grabbed that one. Because lithium will be the limiting factor for some period of time, only because of situations like Tesla doing what they did on Battery Day, announcing their lithium's everywhere and it's easy to produce. And, you know, we're just going to pick up dirt and mix it with table salt and that's going to be the answer. And gee, nobody ever thought of that before. That does such a disservice to, I talk to sovereign funds. I talk to multi-billion dollar companies, literally, that are looking at the space now to see where should we invest in the transition of energy to green energy. And look at what's happened with lithium investment. It's not happening. And in fairness, I mean, if you're a hedge fund guy, you got no line of sight on what prices. There's no LME. There's right now a short-term oversupply. And it's a small industry. The entire global demand for lithium chemicals didn't reach $1 billion until 2015. Think about that. It's nothing. If you're Exxon and you buy the whole lithium industry, it doesn't move your needle.
Yeah, that's really amazing perspective, actually, when you put it that way, which is, yeah, for these huge players, a $1 billion business is kind of a startup in the portfolio. You've got to be bringing something much bigger than that to get a lot of attention and a lot of investment. And so that really puts a fine point on what a niche it has been up to this point. Let's transition into Battery Day. And, you know, this is an area for us that is just ripe with a lot of things to discuss with you. And we'll try and keep it serious and not just poke fun at what was said at Battery Day, but really want to get a little inside baseball from you on what the chatter is like, you know, in your industry, having heard some of this. So you alluded to it before, but I will just read what Elon claimed, which I think was the most, I don't know, I would say stunning or jaw-dropping statement in Battery Day, which was the table salt, which was the table salt statement. So for those of our listeners that either couldn't stomach watching Battery Day or didn't read the transcript as I did, let me just read that point to you. So Elon says, quote, "And we actually discovered, looking again at a sort of first principles of physics standpoint, instead of just the way it's always been done, it is what we found that we can actually use table salt, sodium chloride, to basically extract lithium from the ore. And nobody's done this before, to the best of my knowledge," end quote. So what were you thinking when you hear Elon Musk, who has zero experience in lithium mining and no actual earned expertise in the space, essentially denigrate the entire approach to the field of lithium mining and that he's just stumbled on this incredibly revolutionary way to upend the industry?
Well, I have some background in knowing what Tesla doesn't know about lithium, which is most, you know, quite a bit, because when the Gigafactory was announced, I was advising a company called Symbol Materials that Elon ultimately tried to buy, and that's well documented. His offer letter to John Burba, it's been published. And I was at Battery Japan in Tokyo, and I was on the phone with Kurt Kelty and a bunch, and that's probably a familiar name to you, and you know, a bunch of the Gigafactory team. And I sent a slide, and the message on the slide was, "You're screwed." And they didn't like that very much. They were like, "Well, why are we screwed?" And I said, "You don't even know where the lithium comes from. This is, you know, I mean, 2014. And this is a bit of a digression. But I said, look, the top three lithium producers in the world have a capacity of 18,000 metric tons of lithium hydroxide right now. And only 8,500 tons of that capacity is qualified for Sumitomo Metal Mining to use. if you ever get to 35 gigawatt hours, you're going to need 28,000 tons of lithium hydroxide. And oh, the news gets worse. Guess who your competition is for that lithium hydroxide? It's Big Oil. Big Oil makes lithium grease. And you know what? On the lithium commodities list in those offices of Big Oil, lithium's on page 4. And the guy doesn't really care about anything but the top 10 names on page 1. So if the price goes up, they just pay it because it's a nuisance to them. So because Tesla actually came in to a lithium project, the Symbol Materials geothermal project, and said, oh, we need $3,500 a ton lithium hydroxide. And nobody's cash cost in the industry was anywhere near that. It was all the nonsense of, well, you guys just need to get better. I mean, look at us, look at what we're doing. We're changing the world and you guys are just mired in your old ways. And this was telling this to somebody who was trying to do something that had never been done before, which was, you know, basically produce lithium from geothermal brine. And, you know, it just was nonsensical. So my background on the way they approach it, and I was in the room on Sand Hill Road in Palo Alto when the venture capitalists who had the interest in that project got Elon's offer, and they came back with a number more than 4 times as large as Elon's offer. And, you know, Elon basically said, piss off in the meeting, and that acquisition didn't happen. But what Tesla did in a petulant response was they came back in the next year and signed supply agreements with two companies, Pure Energy and Bacanora, Pure Energy being in Nevada and Bacanora being in Sonora in Mexico. And those two companies haven't produced a kilogram of commercial lithium in 5 years. And those agreements were nonsense. And so what did they do on Battery Day? They also announced, well, they didn't announce it on Battery Day. It was announced later, which was kind of an issue also with the Australian Stock Exchange. But Piedmont Lithium, which is trying to restart mining in North Carolina, not too far from where I'm sitting, you know, they announced a supply agreement with Piedmont. Piedmont hasn't even started building a mine. In fact, Piedmont had said not too long ago that they were just going to go ahead and build a hydroxide plant at first and source the spodumene from Western Australia. So it's just been a daisy chain. I mean, Elon wanted to make an announcement on Battery Day. And so a lot of people missed all this because there were moving parts. He was talking about clay on one hand in Nevada, and then they talked about they were going to, you know, have a converter plant in Austin, Texas. And those discussions were not well understood. And the industry has really reacted negatively to, obviously, it's kind of fatuous to think you pick up some dirt, you mix it with table salt, and you put the dirt back. I mean, I'm really anxious to see him pull that one off, especially even in Nevada is a very mining friendly province. There's a lot more to it than that. Bringing a mining project when you just got your 10,000 acres is going to take a long time. And I don't believe they'll do it. I don't even believe it'll really move forward, but yeah, I could be wrong.
So I happen to agree. And, you know, lots we could discuss. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about though, is sort of Elon is an extreme example of a more generalized phenomenon in that the auto industry are particularly terrible to their suppliers.
Absolutely.
And Elon in particular, there's lots of stories. I know many people in the automotive supply space on the material side. And, you know, there's lots of stories about Elon throwing his phone at a certain CEO because he was unhappy with how things were going. I get the sense that Tesla in particular, but the industry in general, is not really ready to catalyze the growth needed in the lithium space to satisfy the projected needs of the EV space. And I wonder whether Elon is just coming to that realization and Battery Day wasn't just sort of a flailing about of various ideas. You know, a couple of days later, we saw this story that was since denied that they were thinking about taking a 10% equity stake in LG. He seems to be all over the map. Do you think that's because they don't really have a lithium strategy for the growth that he has promised the street?
I think that's a good summary. But I think your broader topic is very relevant. Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes, they don't have cogent lithium strategies either. And I remember a few years ago, Volkswagen had in Wolfsburg what I just called the lithium inquisition. They called all the suppliers in, and they were going to put them up in the local stadium in the boxes and then go from room to room and kind of break them, you know, and it didn't work out too well. You know, the more important lithium players didn't send anybody, and the ones that did, it was just kind of a joke, because at the end of the day, Volkswagen or Tesla or BMW needs to be enabling lithium supply. They don't understand that lithium is not, excuse the term, going to be the auto industry's bitch. It's just not going to happen. And they will be. I mean, if you're a Volkswagen or if you're a BMW and you say, okay, we're putting $80 billion into EVs over this time frame, or, you know, pick your number. A lot of numbers have been thrown out there. And then the primary, you know, you can make a lithium battery without nickel. You can make a lithium battery without cobalt, but you can't make a lithium battery without lithium. And they wouldn't have to do very much to enable investment. Do some legitimate contracts, take small equity pieces, you know, make the rest of the investing world comfortable that this is really going to happen, because there's a lot of cynicism out there still. Your audience are EV believers, but there's a large part of the investing world that is still looking at this thing and saying, I'm not sure.
So speaking of our audience, certainly a large part of them are investors, and that's often how they come into this space, having started perhaps at a fundamental point of view, looking at companies, getting very skeptical, as in the case of Tesla, and then kind of punching through that and not being able to let go. But from an investing point of view, as our listeners might have a greater interest in lithium, with the caveat that nothing that you would say here is investment advice, can you give a little bit of a sense of how one might consider investing in lithium, you know, long or short, and what are some of the common available ways to do that for the average investor?
Okay, I don't do short, so I'll leave that to some of your other guests. I think right now is high quality lithium assets. A company like Albemarle, or I mean, you can take any of the majors, and if you believe the thesis, if you fundamentally believe that EV penetration is going to go to 10% or 15% or 20% or pick your number, then that's a great story for lithium. Because in order for that to happen, demand has to triple by 2025. And if you believe Elon's number for 2030, just for them, it has to go up 8 times. And it's essentially historic fact now. You can look at any lithium project that's been started in the last few years. It's been late. It's produced less than people thought it would produce. So what does that mean for the existing producers? It means prices going north. And it's probably going to, you know, I don't like to put an exact date on, because then I get Twitter hate. Oh, you said this. But, you know, I called the last cycle pretty well. And, you know, I think certainly by 2022, there's going to be a significant shortage. And prices are gonna go high, and companies like Albemarle and SQM and Livent are all gonna do well. If you've got the stomach to invest in Chinese stocks, Ganfeng is a good play. But most of my money, I mean, I've got a lot of shares of Lithium Americas, and I've bought mine at 2 and 3, and it was selling for over 10 yesterday, and I firmly believe that, because they have the next brine play in partnership with Ganfeng that's coming on in Argentina. And then they have Thacker Pass, which, if you're going to develop a clay asset in Nevada, Thacker Pass is what you do. And the other issue as we play out this lithium demand is there is a dearth of experience in the lithium industry, because for 20 years, there wasn't a new project built. And going forward with the amount of lithium that needs to come online, there's going to be a lot of tuition paid because this, you know, people say, well, this isn't rocket science, and the mining's not. I mean, the Australians have proven that it's easy to mine the lithium, but lithium is not a mining business. Lithium is a chemical business, and I would say it's a specialty chemical business. And that's where the experience, it takes time. And so you can hire any of the big engineering companies, and basically what you're doing when you do that is you pay their people to learn on the job. And that's going to be another speed bump on the way to the next time we go into shortage. It'll be a long time before we're in oversupply if 10% EV penetration happens, if 15% EV penetration happens. The other question that you asked that I didn't answer was about, you know, if you have a million EVs, you have to frame it with what do you believe your average battery size is. So if you say it's a 60 kilowatt hour battery, then you're going to need 48 kilos of LCE for that car, and then just multiply it out. So pick your number of cars, pick your average battery size, and multiply it by 0.8, and that's how that works.
So from an investment point of view, what is your perspective on battery recycling and recycled lithium? I believe you refer to it as urban mining. My understanding is that it's fairly uneconomic, but I don't know if you see that changing or what the prospects are for recycling.
Well, that was another one of the comedy of, I mean, there were a lot of good things said at Battery Day. I like the bigger cells. I like some of the other things that were said. But once you get out of what you really know, then it just degenerates into Elon makes it up and hopes most people believe him. And, you know, the whole lithium is the least valuable of the elements that you're going after in recycling. And I recently did a podcast episode with Chris Reed, who's working on recycling. And he brought one of the recent mines into production in Western Australia. He's a fourth generation miner, so he pretty much knows what he's talking about. And it's gonna, whether the lithium, I mean, the nickel and the cobalt are much more valuable than the lithium. And then when you get to lithium, and Chris talks about his process, that they can do battery quality cobalt or nickel from their process, but lithium is a little iffy. And so you're probably going to be, the lithium you do produce is probably going to have to go someplace else and be upgraded before it goes into a battery. And the way Battery Day just kind of waved the hands and said, magically, it's just going to, you know, we're going to have this virtuous circle, I think is, you know, maybe that happens, but I'll probably be dead when it does.
So, Joe, last technical question before we end with a commercial for Joe Lowry, because, by the way, this has been absolutely fantastic, and we're sitting here excited to edit it and release it for our audience because they're going to lap it all up. Let's talk about clay. And when, you know, Georgia read that quote, Elon saying, "I'm just going to sprinkle some table salt on it and magically the lithium will fall out." We heard about the, you know, evaporation process. We've heard about the hard rock mining. My understanding is there are no commercially operating lithium mines today that use clay, and that there is no commercially ready clay extraction process because it's just not viable. One, is that true? Two, I know you have some experience and some knowledge in the space. Maybe fill the audience in a little bit about clay and that process and its potential impact in the lithium space.
Well, there's a volcanologist named Tom Benson, and he urged me to stop saying clay and start saying sedimentary deposit. So I'm not a quick study, but I do learn in time. So I'm going to call it sedimentary. And this project in Nevada called Thacker Pass that Lithium Americas has is probably going to be the first commercial sedimentary play. I would say it's probably 3 or 4 years out because they have to get Kachari online and they have to get Thacker Pass financed. But this project was owned by a company called Western Lithium that ultimately merged with LAC. And in the days when it was Western Lithium's project, I said a lot of negative things about it for two reasons. One is at that time, lithium prices were at a level where it was going to be a really tough sell because it's not going to be as low cost as brine. And then when Lithium Americas got a hold of it, and Lithium Americas has probably the best management team in the industry. And so my old boss at FMC came back and is CEO of LAC. Rene LeBlanc is probably the most knowledgeable person on lithium hydroxide production on the planet. He worked for FMC with me for years, went to work for Tesla. People don't tend to stay long at Tesla. There are a lot of Tesla ex-lithium alums that I know. And they have a really strong team. And the only unfortunate circumstance is that their partner, Gangfen, and I'm the one who introduced them to Gangfen. Gangfen can't invest in Thacker Pass because of CFIUS regulations, because they're a Chinese company. And so they're going to have to find the financing somewhere else. But they've ticked all the boxes so far. They have a pilot plant in Reno that I've visited a couple of times. And they produce a quality lithium sulfate solution from that asset now. And it is going through the process of having third parties put processes together for carbonate and hydroxide. So I believe that because you have put a good team on it, they've totally changed the flow sheet. And, you know, you can go on their website and read more about that. I don't want to do a shameless plug. I mean, full disclosure, Lithium Americas is a client of mine, but it's more about the people. The biggest issue with a lithium project now, assuming at least a marginal asset, is the team bringing it online. And Lithium Americas has a very good team, plus Gangfen's helping them with process work too. And Gangfen is probably the best processor of lithium on the planet. And I have a podcast episode about that too. It's a great story. So I don't know where that leaves us.
Well, actually, that leads us into asking you to share a little bit more about your organization and your podcast. This has been a really terrific overview, Joe, and I have no doubt that there will be some of our listeners that may be interested to go a couple layers deeper into understanding the lithium mining and some of the industry dynamics. I can say, as someone who listened to a number of your podcasts in preparation for today, that you do go into great detail, and my hope is that this discussion that we've just had will give folks enough of the shop talk that they need to be able to follow along in your podcasts if they're interested to do that. So why don't you talk a little bit about Global Lithium in more detail, how people can learn more and get involved? That would be great.
Well, Global Lithium is essentially yours truly and my faithful mixed breed dog. But I do have contacts all over the world. I mean, after Battery Day, I was on the phone with people on three different continents asking technical questions about different things that were said. I have probably as good a network as anyone in the industry. And that's what kind of differentiates what I do from a lot of the other talking heads who couldn't spell lithium 5 years ago, but now are self-minted experts. I have done a lot of work. I have clients on five continents, retainer clients. I do a lot of one-off studies and that sort of thing. I didn't even have a website until COVID and my daughter was home for a while because I didn't need one. I was just on Twitter and LinkedIn and I stayed busy to the extent that I wanted to. But it was ironic. I had a large company that needed to pay me, and their accounting company called me and said, "Hey, what's your website?" I said, "I don't have a website. I don't need a website." And they were like, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, my podcast is on Anchor. So, I mean, you can go look at that or you can look at my LinkedIn profile." And it was amazing to me how big a deal that was. And these guys didn't want to pay me because they thought, "Oh, well, we have all these compliance issues and maybe you're a drug dealer." And I was like, A drug dealer advising
antidepressants.
Your company on lithium. So I do have globallithium.net is my website. It's, I guess, hopefully that's legitimized me.
Gosh, if having a website is all that's needed for legitimacy, we are in bigger trouble than I thought.
Well, you know, and it's also comical. I've written extensively on LinkedIn, and I know my LinkedIn posts have been translated into multiple languages by people who just did it for their local people. I mean, I got all the Chinese language translation. I had nothing to do with it. It's the podcast has been heard in 101 countries as of a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it's more than that now, but I'm kind of running out of room. It's on Anchor FM, but you can get it. You can get the latest episodes on my website. It's also, you can get it on the same, just like with you, Apple, Spotify, Pocket Casts, the Global Lithium Podcast. There was an older version when I used to have a partner, and that website's still out there too, I believe. But everything now is, when it's posted via Anchor, which feeds everybody else. And yeah, I mean, it's a very simple life. I mean, I'm not an EV guy. I'm a lithium guy. It's a very narrow field, and I try to stay up to speed. And yeah, and I used to run a cathode business as part of my job when I worked for FMC, a joint venture we had. And you know, I was dealing with BYD and all those companies from 2000, or in some cases earlier than that.
They say the riches are in the niches, and you've certainly carved out a very lucrative one, given how the market dynamics, I think, are about to play out. One of the magical things about Twitter is just how interconnected it is. And I would say that, you know, from my original DM a week ago on Battery Day to having you here on the podcast educating our audience, it's really proof of just how, you know, connected the world is. And I want to say how grateful we are that you agreed to do this show. I think our audience is going to love it. Super thrilled to have met you, and happy to have spent the last hour and change learning alongside our audience about what's going on in the lithium space from somebody who really knows the stuff. So really appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot for doing it.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. You know, if you ever want to talk again, you know how to find me.
Absolutely. Welcome anytime, Joe. Thanks so much.
Tesla owners, when you pull away from a station after a charge, you want the world to know that you are living large. As Ross Gerber said, you want to rip off people's face. A Tesla coming off the line at a red light should never be in second place. And in the event of a battery fire, well, ice cars burn too. But here's exactly what you, the Tesla owner, should do. The flames, compared to ice cars, will be neither higher nor shorter. So just stand back and watch as the fire department puts your car safely into a large tub of cold water. Because lithium does burn a little different from gas. But as you watch the flames dwindle, keep in mind, this too shall pass.